Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. There's a lot about this next case that is confusing. The crimes themselves are horrible, but that's not the confusing part. It's the bizarre and sometimes malicious actions, as well as the random inactions of police and prosecutors involved, that I blame for most of my bewilderment. That and the fact that I'm not Italian. I once got married in Italy, but that's for another podcast. Even so, I don't read or speak Italian, which I wish I did, because that would probably spare me some one-star reviews hating on my pronunciations this episode, for which I apologize in advance. More than that, though, it would have helped a lot in reading the original documents in this case. And maybe it would have helped me better understand the difference between the police and the carabinieri and why you need two agencies that do basically the same thing but manage to always get in each other's way. And that's the bottom line. Not being Italian meant that unraveling the crimes assigned to the mysterious Il Mostro di Firenze, or as we'll call him, the Monster of Florence, proved trying because the customs of that country differ from ours, as does their legal system. It also means that I'm not sure who to believe when authorities start blaming each other. The Sicilian Mafia, Satan worshippers, the Zodiac Killer, a cuckolded husband, and a man who raped his own daughters, all at various times for the same crimes. It has created a morass of rumors that have not been dispelled or explained or tied together in almost 50 years of trying. But make no mistake, for Italy, this is their crime of the century. There is horror enough for all of us to call it so. So much so that I want to warn you up front that the murders, while seemingly random, are shockingly sadistic and involve female mutilation that, I'm sorry to say, I feel like I have to include so that you understand the depth of depravity here and the absolute terror the killer invoked in an entire generation of Italian lovers. All 16 of his victims, 8 couples actually, were killed between 1968 and 1985 while engaging in intimate relations in their cars, campers, or tents in the Tuscan countryside in and around Florence. It was the media, specifically a reporter named Mario Spezzi with La Nazione, who named the perpetrator the Monster of Florence. Because of Spezzi's familiarity with law enforcement and because of lax security around crime scenes, he saw firsthand in 1981 what the monster was capable of. You will soon see why no one would ever claim the killer was not aptly named. Let us begin at the beginning. Though the first murders took place in 1968 and were not linked to the other murders until an anonymous letter urged the police to take a second look. On the warm and dark night of August 21, 1968, when the only moon was a new moon, Barbara Locci and Antonio Lobianco had gone to the movies. They brought along Barbara's 6-year-old son, Natalino, who had fallen asleep in the back seat. He was not Lobianco's child, and Lobianco was also not Barbara's husband. Barbara's husband was not invited on this date, but they were still married, even though she was known to enjoy the intimate company of other men on a regular basis. Antonio and Barbara were having sex when a shooter reached into an open back window and fired at the pair at close range. The .22 caliber Beretta didn't miss. Barbara was hit 3 times, Antonio 4. It's suspected that both died instantly, though it was later alleged that the gunman next handed the gun to Stefano Mili, Barbara's husband, who fired a final shot that did little damage to his already dead wife. In the reports made later, there are 2 versions of the crime, the one that included Stefano's presence and the other, which suggested that Natalino was terrorized by a Carabinieri investigator into saying so. What happened next is also up for debate. In one version, Stefano picked up his son and walked him to a nearby farmhouse and left him there. In the other, Natalino got there on his own. This is what Samuel Ayling, the host of Lazy Masquerade, a British true crime podcast, reported in 2021.
But when a sharp jolt suddenly woke the boy up, he opened his eyes to a truly horrifying sight. The car he had been sleeping in had crashed, and behind a cracked and splintered windshield, Antonio and his mother, Barbara, lay slumped in their seats, both of them riddled with bullets that leaked fresh blood onto the upholstery. Natalino then descended into a state of shock, because, the way he describes it, he just ran, instinctually fleeing the scene to escape the mind-shattering trauma. Next thing he knew, it was almost 2 a.m., and he was 2 kilometers away, knocking at the home of a complete stranger.
In both versions, the little boy is reported to have explained in a shaky voice, "Open the door and let me in. I'm sleepy and my daddy is sick in bed. Then you have to drive me home because my mother and my uncle are dead in their car." Except, of course, the dead man was not his uncle. Natalino later would name a bona fide uncle who was there, Uncle Piero, though that cleared up nothing because Natalino had 2 uncles, one named Piero, and the other named Pietro. His father, Stefano, who may have been innocent of all of it, was arrested and later convicted of the crime. For the wanton and premeditated murder of 2 people, Stefano was sentenced to just 14 years in prison. And this is a great example of the difference between Italian and American jurisprudence. In the U.S., a man who was found guilty of conspiring to kill 2 people in cold blood and allowed his child to witness the carnage would likely be thrown so far into prison he'd never see the sunshine again, generally speaking. Anyway, no one else was charged despite both Stefano and his small son mentioning to police, then recanting their statements, that a man named Salvatore Vinci, who lived in the same house as Mili and his wife, was on the scene that night, and that Vinci fired the fatal shots. Everyone seemed to forget about the uncle Natalino had said was there, but he was just 6, so maybe that makes sense. Not neat, not tidy, not even rock solid, but someone was held responsible, and the story made sense? Which seemed good enough at the time. 6 years passed, and Stefano was still behind bars when another copulating couple was shot and killed in their car. No one connected the dots.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's FORHERS.com/talk. Tom Pandya products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Newsrooms are funny places, and I guess that applies everywhere. They used to be full of a lot of folks who knew a lot about a little and a little about everything, which was useful. That explains how, in 1981, when crime reporter Spitzi was 3 days into covering the murders of a young couple, that another reporter remembered a couple had been similarly killed 7 years earlier, in 1974. Spitzi did some quick research and recalled the 1974 story the next day for his Italian readership, and, not inconsequentially, any law enforcement officer who happened to read the paper. He told how, on September 14, 1974, Stefania Pettini and Pasquale Gentilcore, 18 and 19 respectively, had left a discotheque, then parked in a secluded vineyard to have sex. Usually a fun, easygoing couple, this night their friends had noticed that they were decidedly not so.
When they were asked what was bothering them, Stefania told her friend that a few days prior, a strange man had followed her during a driving lesson. She had forgotten about it soon after, but had spotted that same man earlier that evening, almost as if he was stalking her. When asked what the man looked like, Stefania could only give a vague description, but added that there was something about this man that she found terrifying.
When they were later found, both had been fatally shot, but Stefania had also been dragged from the car and stabbed 97 times around her breasts and pubic area. A grapevine stalk had been shoved up her vagina, yet there was no evidence that she'd been sexually molested otherwise. The killer, or killers, had left behind spent cartridges. The bullets retrieved from the bodies showed that the weapon that fired the bullets had a unique defect that would help a lot to identify the gun that fired them, should the police ever get that lucky. The police, now reminded of that crime by Spitzi's story, immediately retrieved the 1974 cold case file on Pettini and Gentilcore. The bullets found that day indeed matched the ones embedded in the couple found only days before, on June 7, 1981. Spitzi had correctly tied the two cases together. In this newest case, Spitzi had seen the carnage firsthand before the crime scene was swarmed by official types. He had been doing his routine early Sunday morning rounds to police headquarters when the chief of the mobile squad got the call that there were two bodies in a car in a remote area. Spitzi followed the chief to the scene. No one stopped him when he got to the deserted olive grove where a man was found dead in his car. The woman he had been with was found a short distance away, naked, shot in the back. Now face up, her entire pubic region had been cut away, taken apparently as a souvenir by the killer. Giovanni Foggi, 30, and Carmela DiNucci, 21, had planned to marry. Spitzi at first thought the grotesque mutilation was the result of animals having eaten the dead woman. He was rapidly disabused of that notion as experts weighed in on the type of knife that was used to make the incision. As Spitzi said,
she had, very shockingly, a wound below her abdomen that could not really be described as a wound. It was like her lower abdomen was missing.
It was clear now that Italy had its own Jack the Ripper. The Italian police and Carabinieri began searching in earnest for suspects, the gun, and the truly unanswerable why. This is when I was enlightened by some common customs that Italy has that I wasn't aware of. This is from Mario Spezi and Doug Preston's book, The Monster of Florence. Quote, "The investigation that followed lifted the lid off a bizarre underworld that few Florentines knew existed in the lovely hills surrounding their city. In Italy, most people live at home with their parents until they marry, and most marry late. As a result, having sex in parked cars is a national pastime. It has been said that one out of every three Florentines alive today was conceived in a car." End quote. And the authors add, quote, "The investigators discovered that dozens of voyeurs prowled the countryside spying on the couples. Some carried sophisticated electronic equipment, including parabolic and suction cup microphones and night vision cameras," end quote. True crime YouTuber Stephanie Harlow.
During their investigation, the police discovered that there was a whole community of voyeurs, surprisingly well-organized and well-equipped creeps who would get together at a local restaurant called Taverna del Diablo and discuss their nocturnal plans for the evening.
Like who was going where and exchanging maps to make sure no one trespassed on the other's territory. WTF. Then, if that weren't creepy enough, a whole nother group of people made a living off of taking pictures of the voyeurs and blackmailing them, threatening to expose their fetish. This explains why and how one of the voyeurs, Enzo Spalletti, was fingered for the 1981 crime. He had no real alibi and folded a bit under questioning, saying he'd been in the area and had watched this particular couple more than once.
He was known as a peeping Tom. It was believed he was discovered watching this couple and had reacted by killing them. It looked like it was nothing more than a tragic story.
The Carabinieri threw Spalletti in jail. Spezi looked for anything that connected him to the 1974 murders, and then, 4.5 months after Giovanni and Carmela had been killed, another couple was found dead. On the night of October 23, 1981, under yet another new moon, Stefano Baldi, 26, and Susa Cambi, 24, were shot with a .22 Beretta, leaving 11 spent shells behind. Susanna was dead when dragged from the car and similarly mutilated. Spezi again.
You could not help but notice the beauty of the girl, of her face. And at the same time, the mutilation was terrible, worse than the earlier ones.
Someone who may have seen the killer that night gave a description to police which they chose not to share with the public. The police then released Enzo Spalletti because the case against him had just been dealt a fatal blow. The medical examiner decided the instrument used to eviscerate the women was a scuba knife. A colonel from the Carabinieri, the Italian paramilitary police who also investigate crimes and act like a civil police force as well as being a branch of the armed services, found something he deemed odd near the crime scene. A sort of triangular pillar of granite, doorstop-sized. He stashed it with the evidence, but he was pretty sure it had some significance. It will make a reappearance. At this point, Italy was in full panic. Spezi worked on nothing else. All manner of tips and leads, mostly anonymous, came in, which had to be investigated. Lovers opted for safer sex elsewhere. Police began randomly accusing a whole slew of men. Spezi and Preston wrote that, quote, "Doctors, surgeons, gynecologists, and even priests were among the accused, along with fathers, sons-in-laws, lovers, and rivals," end quote. 8 months after the third couple had been gunned down in June 1982, 20-something Antonella Miorini had told people how she was afraid of the monster, but she loved Paolo Mainardi, so they took a drive. They didn't even really leave the main road that night, parking where they thought they were in plain sight, believing that would deter the monster from approaching. The two had accomplished what they went there for, and Antonella was getting dressed in the back seat when Paolo saw the murderer approaching. Paolo gunned the motor, backing out and into the ditch on the opposite side of the road, badly lodging the car in place. The monster had shot Paolo once in the shoulder, but now shot out the headlights and moved to the car, where he placed a bullet in both their heads. He then moved Paolo aside to take the wheel and tried to move the car. But the road was busy, and he gave up, opting not to take the time to mutilate Antonella. When help arrived, Paolo was still barely alive, and they knew if they could keep him breathing, they would have an eyewitness. But alas. Ambulance driver Lorenzo Allegranti.
He died in the morning at around 4:15. It was a big blow, because by saving him, things could have been different.
Then those in charge had an idea. They asked the press to print that Paolo had survived and was in the hospital, hoping that the monster would show himself or make a mistake. Additionally, they decided to give the press the sketch that a police artist had made of the man seen close to the car that Baldi and Cambi had died in. You know, in reading about these crimes, I was continually struck by how incredibly romantic the settings sound. These murders took place in Tuscan vineyards, olive groves, foothills, near centuries-old castles, in the Chianti countryside. Everywhere, everything was lush and fragrant, where young people went to be young and desired. It doesn't mean that murders in sordid places are less heartbreaking, but the contrast just underscores that no place is safe. The Archbishop of Florence said it infinitely better when he spoke at the funeral of Paolo and Antonella. Quote, "Much has been said in these recent tragic days of monsters, of madness, of crimes of unimaginable viciousness, but we know well that madness does not arise out of nowhere. Madness is the irrational and violent explosion of a world, a society that has lost its values, that every day becomes more inimical to the human spirit. This afternoon, we stand here mute witnesses to one of the worst ever defeats of all that is good in mankind." End quote.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tomtandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
The tale of the Monster of Florence is about to get odd. The investigation, I mean, because in interviewing and re-interviewing people, the police and the press decided to circle back to the first man accused of the first crime, Stefano Mili, who is now out of prison. Now, the bullets that killed his wife and her partner matched those used in later crimes, but no one ever found the gun. And while Mili was confused, incoherent, and inconsistent when questioned in 1981, everyone noticed when he said the murders would continue and, when he talked about the monster, how he always spoke in the plural, they, he kept saying. This opened a whole new avenue. Was this a cult killing? Or worse, a vendetta? And into the rabbit hole investigators went, a hole that would later become known as the Sardinian Trail, which I'm about to explain as best I can. Italy was fiefdoms and principalities and whatnot until 1871, and when unification began, Sardinians lost out on a few counts. The language that got spoken from thenceforth would not be Italy's official tongue. That was, instead, the one spoken by the erudite, sophisticate artists and Renaissance wunderkind Florentines. A lot of Sardinians still didn't speak that language a century later, being largely uneducated and poor, scrubbing for a better life. But even outcasts had outcasts, and those lived in the South Sardinian town of Villacidro, a country of shadows and witches. The Vincis lived there, not the ones you know, those related to Leonardo da Vinci, or more precisely, Leonardo di Ser Piero da Vinci, which translates kind of badly to Leonard, son of Piero from Vinci, the Tuscan village in which he was born. The Vincis the cops were looking for were two brothers, Francesco and Salvatore, surnamed Vinci. Salvatore had apparently left Sardinia and moved to Tuscany, where he roomed in the home of Stefano Mili and his less-than-faithful wife, Barbara. But it was Francesco who piqued investigators' interest the most. They considered him
a notorious thug. He was a macho man who liked to show off his masculinity to women. Vinci had a reputation for being violent.
This is from a BBC documentary.
As investigators become convinced they have a prime suspect in their sights, new evidence appears, which could confirm their suspicions. Days after the murder of Paolo Menardi and Antonella Migliorini, an abandoned car was found hidden in the woods. The owner has finally been traced. The car belongs to Francesco Vinci.
The police became convinced that Francesco, who had done much to warrant their concern, was involved, so he was jailed while the investigation was ongoing. Hold on to that thought. On September 10th, 1983, very near an ancient villa that had belonged to nobility, a spot where Charles and Diana had stayed shortly after they wed, so you know it was uber posh, two men were found slaughtered in their VW bus. Both 24, Horst Meyer and Uwe Rusch, were touring Italy when the couple was shot. Both were naked. The now too familiar .22 Beretta had been used again. Police soon surmised that the victims, maybe like all the victims, had been randomly chosen. One of the men was thin and, at quick glance, could have been mistaken for female. No one was mutilated. Francesco Vinci had been in jail for 13 months and thus innocent of this one. A Florentine magistrate decided to announce then that the monster was multiple people, and Francesco was still a suspect because, he assured everyone, Francesco had family and friends who were just as evil as he. Not long after, Francesco's nephew, Antonio, was arrested on a weapons charge. They admitted nothing. The police were looking inept. In many ways, they had been. The crime scenes had not been routinely secured. Francesco Donato, head of the forensic science lab for the Tuscan police.
Nobody was wearing shoe covers, nobody wore gloves, and nobody wore overalls. That time, there were not the precautions at the crime scene that today are considered standard.
More than that, no agency ever asked to compare the knife wounds or incision cuttings to those which had been used on six sex workers who had died at the hand of their own serial killer in Florence around the same time. The Carabinieri had clashed with the local police, and both agencies had tussled with an array of prosecutors and magistrates over who and what was legitimate evidence here. Let me give you an example of something that would later call into question a lot of the police procedure used or misused during the now 15-year-old investigation. The bullets that were found in 1968 were evidence in a closed case. Salvador Mili was convicted and had completed his sentence, and as such, per Italian law, were supposed to have been destroyed. Why were they suddenly found? And why were they found outside of the appropriate storage unit where evidence was stored? Why were they found in a policeman's case file? Police, to avoid embarrassment, I guess, now countered with an announcement that two previously unidentified men were the Monster of Florence and had been arrested. Their names? Giovanni Mili, Stefano's brother, and Piero Muccheroni, Stefano's brother-in-law. Now, four people were in jail, each suspected of being a part of this serial slaughter. And because, well, Italy, six different prosecutors were involved. Another prosecutor was assigned to be the public minister or the judge. Even native-born Spizzi would later say that the tangle of information and rash of conclusion jumping coming from that sector was impossible to follow. So I don't feel so bad. Then, on July 30th, 1984, a day after the appearance of the only new moon that was to appear that summer, Pierrontini, 19, and Claudio Stefanacci, 20, were found dead. He had been shot in his car, where he remained. She had been dragged post-mortem into a field. Her vagina and left breast had been removed. Or, as Spizzi wrote, removed is not appropriate. It was, he explained, ripped off. This, while all four of those accused of being the instruments of the previous monster deaths cooled their heels in Italian jails under the careful watch of its keepers. By now, all of Europe and a lot of the rest of the world had been following the story of what was happening in the beautiful Tuscan countryside. A wide array of books, fictional and non, as well as graphic novels, began to flood the market there and around the world. The horror traveled wide enough and far enough to convince Thomas Harris, the man who created Hannibal Lecter, to write a sequel in which Lecter moves to Florence, takes a new name, and, well, Chianti and fava beans for everyone. The jailed men, who made up the one Monster of Florence, were, soon after, quietly released. On September 9, 1985, a Monday, two people who had been dead and baking in the Tuscan sun were found in a tent in what originally appeared to be a confused crime scene. Nadine Mauriette, 36, and her live-in boyfriend, Jean-Michel Cravicvili, 25, had obviously camped there, taking in the sights and each other when the killers slid open the tent and fired, killing Nadine immediately. Jean-Michel, young and athletic, had been hit a few times, but he took off running. He was later found stabbed in the back, chest, and torso before his throat was cut. Nadine was then dragged out of the tent, mutilated as per his custom, her left breast obliterated. The young man was left under some trash. Nadine was returned to the tent, which had been neatly zipped up. The next day, a letter arrived for one of the female prosecutors on the case. It contained a piece of Nadine Moriette's breast. I told you this was going to be inordinately awful. It was also the last of the killings, but how could anyone know that then? The female prosecutor left the case. A month later, in October, Francesco Narducci, a young doctor, disappeared off his boat in Lake Trasimeno, later to be found dead. The timing would bring suspicion down upon him and a local pharmacist who had a pharmacy near a place where police said some of their other suspects liked to drink, and they were now grasping at straws. Then, a surprise. A soldier named Giuseppe, he went by Joseph, Bevilacqua, who was a suspect in the Zodiac Killer case in the U.S., was found to have been stationed in Italy at the Florence American Cemetery when LoBianca and Loci were killed in 1968. Investigators found that he had returned to the U.S. for the first time period when the Zodiac deaths occurred, only for him to return to Italy after the last Zodiac letter was received. The move dated to January 1974, just before the monster killings began. Stephanie Harlow again.
Many people think they are one and the same and have done research and put together charts and timetables to show how the Zodiac Killer and the Florence Monster could be the same person and how they could have traveled, because these crimes did not happen at the same time in two different places. So the same person could have been responsible, or the same group of people.
But not everyone investigating the crimes was on the same bus. It's now when Mario Rotella, the examining magistrate or judge, as well as a participant in the investigation, turned up the heat and the accusations and the certainty on his position that Salvatore Vinci and the Sardinian Trail were to blame for all 16 deaths. The Carabinieri put him under 24-hour watch, and finally, in 1986, the state informed Vinci he was suspected of all 16 murders. A trial was set for April 1988, and Salvatore Vinci went on trial for, wait for it, the murder of his wife in 1961. Apparently, this was the strongest case, easiest to prove, simplest to explain to a jury. Now, that murder had originally been called a suicide, but no one really believed that. His wife had been only 17, a young woman who had had to marry because he had raped and impregnated her. She'd been regularly beaten by Salvatore and was, in fact, in love with another man. That couple had been found in bed together by Salvatore, and, well, somehow, she ended up in an apartment filled with propane gas from a tank, which she had earlier reported as empty. Magistrate Rotello had played his best card, and Salvatore was found not guilty. Enter Pietro Pacini, a man as loathsome and evil as any around. He was in prison already for raping his two daughters, having been put there just after the 1985 killing of the French nationals. He had served time in the 1950s after he found his girlfriend naked with another man in a field in Vicchio, a place the monster had since chosen to kill two couples. But years before anyone ever thought of the monster, Pacini had beat the young man found with his girlfriend to death by bashing in his brains, after which he raped his 16-year-old girlfriend while she lay next to the corpse of the other man. Pacini later said the sight of her left breast had brought on his murderous rage. Law enforcement found that detail too good to be true. But still, the evidence against him for these murders was scant. For reasons only they can understand, the Carabinieri, who had been helping the local police all along, got very upset by the decision to go after Pacini and withdrew from any further participation in the investigation. If things weren't already going to hell in a handbasket, a few people decided to make sure it got there because the ongoing effort to put Pacini in prison continued unabated. 8 years passed without enough to indict him when the authorities got permission to do a week-plus search of Pacini's property. Hold up a second. This took 8 years to get done? I mean, I think things could have dawned on someone earlier, but I guess not. This is the man who pursued Pacini the hardest, Police Inspector Ruggero Perugini, in an interview with the BBC.
It is the longest search ever conducted, 11 days and nights, during which we of the squad hardly slept.
On the last day, at the last hour, Perugini saw something shiny on the ground. Lo and behold, it was a .22 Beretta spent cartridge. It did not have the characteristic marks on it that the monster's gun had left on every other cartridge of the crimes. It was, at best, according to the forensic folks, not incompatible with the gun in question. They also said they found an artist's notebook connecting him to the killing of two gay men. Pacini was arrested and charged with being the monster. It did not go well for the defendant, despite the paltry physical evidence the prosecutorial team had gathered. Then Mario Vanni, a friend of Pacini's, a guy that Spezi and Preston would refer to as, quote, a dim-witted ex-postman, end quote, took the stand. It's unclear if he and another friend, Giancarlo Lotti, had already confessed to being accomplices to the killing, as Italian authorities said they did, but that was up for discussion in the trial. Seems that Vanni struggled through his testimony, explaining, then retracting his remarks, tending instead to deflect any hint that he and Pacini and Lotti had ever been up to no good, but saying repeatedly, they were compagni di merende, a term alternately translated as picnicking friends or snack buddies. Feel free to laugh. The apparently well-rehearsed man said it so often and so inanely that it is now a well-known and oft-used euphemism, meaning those who pretend to be innocent but are, in fact, up to no good. Now remember Zodiac suspect Bevilacqua? He showed up as a witness in the Pacini trial, saying he knew him well and had seen him the night of the killings, that he had seen the female victim that day as well, in a black bikini, no less. Then he recanted that. For God's sake, who's in charge here? Pacini was found innocent of the 1968 crime, but guilty of all the others. He got life in prison. So, case closed, right? Not so much. When the automatic appeal of Pietro Pacini's sentence came before a new judge and a fresh prosecutor, both looked at the evidence in the case and could not believe what they saw. This man's conviction was based on the flimsiest of evidence. The police offered up 4 new witnesses, but, get this, they wouldn't identify them to the court. The judge had had enough. He acquitted Pacini of all charges. The Italian version of the Supreme Court then split the difference and ordered a new trial. While awaiting that trial, Pacini died of a heart attack, which stopped no one from deciding Pacini's snack buddies were responsible. So they were charged in 1997 with all but the 1968 murders. A year later, Vanni, the dimwit, got life and Lotti got 26 years. Not for snacking, but for killing all those couples. But they were not the masterminds, claimed a chief inspector named Michel Giuttari, who decided in his infinite wisdom that we were looking at a satanic cult here. Now remember back to that stone that was kind of pyramid-shaped at that one crime scene? Well, that was his evidence. That and that Pacini, when he died, was found to be a man who was hated by his children, but more importantly to Giuttari, he was also a surprisingly rich man. Giuttari said that money came from selling the sex organs of the female murder victims. The Lazy Masquerade podcast again.
According to him, the victims' body parts were being used in an unholy blood ritual.
From there, things just got wilder. Know that Jatari, in 2002, petitioned the court to have the doctor who had died on his boat 16 years earlier exhumed. When DNA proved that the doctor was in the tomb like everyone said he was, Jatari swore that the doctor had not originally been in the tomb but was obviously replaced at a later date, making his theory about something involving the Masons and the murderer make sense, if only to him. You should know as well that Spezi, the journalist, was also accused as an accomplice of the monster because he'd written about the dubious unearthing of the dead doctor. That meant he was subject to repeated searches until, in 2005, his lawyers tried without success to find out exactly what he was going to be charged with. On April 7th, 2006, Spezi was arrested, then released 2 weeks later after the April 19th publication of his and Preston's book about the Monster of Florence. All of this seems to point to some kind of group insanity. It was as if, in the quest to find this killer, law enforcement and officers of the court lost their minds, their ethical boundaries, and any common sense they had ever possessed. But Italy had had enough. Jatari and a fellow prosecutor, Giuliano Mignini, were indicted for abuse of office in the summer of 2006. Jatari was removed from the case and put in a meaningless post. By 2008, Mignini was indicted for illegal wiretapping, obstructing justice, and harassing of newspapers with illegal investigation. Spezi sued for illegal imprisonment. In 2009, Mignini was made public minister of Perugia and the chief prosecutor in a small case there against American Amanda Knox. Now, this is an odd case, one in which some men have been cleared, some even acquitted, and others convicted of involvement in the crimes, and yet no one's ever been ID'd as the orchestrator of the slayings. There's still no known motive. In 2017, the case was reopened to look into Giampiero Vigilante, a man who was questioned 40 years earlier, a one-time member of the French Foreign Legion and a right-wing extremist. Vigilante looked promising. He died in January. He was 93. The case, more or less, remains open. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read The Monster of Florence by Douglas Preston and Mario Spezi. She watched several documentaries about the case, including The Monsters of Florence by filmmaker Andrea Vogt, as well as any documentary on the topic that was in English. For some odd reason, the 2007 Dateline NBC episode about the case is missing in action, though she did read the transcript, which is online. Amber, meanwhile, did some extra reading and also tried her best with the Italian pronunciations. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoy. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page. Empiero's Mucciaroni. Mucciaroni. Mucciaroni.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.